the coalition efforts and all, how important today to be realizing that we are dependent upon our friends in battles. And Gus, why don't you go ahead and tell a story?
My name is Gus Smorenberg. I was born October the 14th, 1921. What makes me about 82 years old, right?
You look good for 82 years old.
Oh, no.
I wouldn't go there if I were you.
On May 10th, 1940, the Germans came into and overran Holland, Belgium, France, and because of business was out of was non-existent, the kids out of high school gathered together and started pestering the Germans. Of course, I can make a long story because we did that all for 40 months, and it takes me about an hour and a half to tell anything about it. But mainly, the things what we did was derailing German trains with war material. We also made spikes to punch trucks, convoys, so that they couldn't go any further. We also have been asked by coded messages from London, that was in the meantime established that with the shortwave radio, please do this and please do that. So they asked us to retrieve pilots who flew over Holland from England to bomb Germany. They asked us to pick up the pilots who were shot down. And I personally picked up five of them out of the woods. We worked only at nights, and this is my Sunday suit, but we had camouflage suits. All total, over the four counties who were involved between England and Germany, there were four counties, we caught 127 pilots. Those pilots were brought to the south of Holland. There was a gentleman who had a cement factory, and he was forced by the Germans to bring concrete to the French coast to make bunkers. After a little while, he went forth and back with the trains. Then the Germans, they came to him and said, "You overcharge us." So, but mainly what we did then, he was also kind of an officer in the resistance. What he did, he put in every boxcar, say four or five pilots, and brought them to the French resistance. The French resistance took it over, brought them to Spain, and from Spain they flew back to England. So really, in that case, there are no POWs. We did many, many things. I could show you. I can show you, for example, what England told us to do. Make spikes. They said, take 6-inch spikes and see that you can stop those trucks. And that's what they did. I'd like to show you what they look like. That's it. No matter how they fell, there was always a spike stayed up. No matter how they fell, there was always a... So that was really the most funny thing we did for us. When we saw a column from, say, 15 or 20 trucks coming up, then we threw, say, two handsful, each of us, say, three or four boys, two handsful of those things on the road. And within, say, 2 minutes, you could see those Germans running around the trucks. Now, what in the heck is going on now, you know? So there are several from those tricks what we did. We started out really they told us that if you put brown sugar in a gasoline tank that or clogs the carburetor or it will when the engine gets hot it will block the engine. We also asked to derail their trains. The first period of time, what we did is put a 2x4. I don't know. You know how a train is directed, say west or east. So I put a 2x4 with a crowbar and put a 2x4 in there, so that train went in the wrong direction. However, after say an hour, you saw them backing up. Then another resistance group in the north of us told us several times there is a heavyweight train on your way. A heavyweight train that means with war material like tanks, cannons, and all that. So then we discussed among us to put two with twos in there. Now the rim on on a wheel from a train is about 3/4 inch thick. So in this case, he couldn't go west or east, but went straight ahead and derailed, because the wheels didn't get their turn that had to have. To make it less difficult for us, we had to reduce our group to 9 boys maximum. We started out with 12, so then we split it up different groups. So what else can I tell you? We did with the here in the stranger.
Yep.
Oh yeah, okay, I see another picture. one afternoon there was a big commotion going on in a wheat field what was next to our subdivision. So the Germans were setting up anti-aircraft cannons. So when we saw that they were shooting, I told one of the guys we should do something about that. So what we did is I asked one of the guys, now our camouflage suit, this is my Sunday suit, but our camouflage suits, what we had on at that time, that was hidden in a barn. So I asked him, he lived close to the barn, so get your my camouflage suit and yours and come on to the Roe and Sail Club. The Roe and Sail Club was a river what was connected to that wheat field. So after some 15 minutes he came there. In the meantime, I took my dad's hacksaw and put it between my belt. But now, between the end of the subdivision and the start of the wheat field, there was a canal about, say, 15 feet, 16 feet wide. But we had to cross that. So those houses on the subdivision, they had power or sailboats. So we went from house to house on the backyard, finding a smaller rowboat to row across a 16-foot canal. So then I crawled through the wheat field, and all of a sudden I come to a pathway about this right of the table. And I thought, hey, that is not the end of the wheat field, is it? Then I saw on my left-hand side a little light going up, about 2 feet, and on down, and up, and down. So I know that there was a watchman, a German, sitting there to watch over the cannon, the generator, and the light source. So after I didn't see the light anymore, then I sneaked across the pathway, and about, maybe 200 to 300 feet further down, I found a cable. It was about an inch thick black cable. And I took my hacksaw and I cut it through. Now you have to realize you had to do that always between 7 o'clock or 6, whenever it was dark, and 9 o'clock when the Allies came over with our planes. So we had at least an hour to do that. Anyhow, I came back to the boat and said, "Darn, Gus, what took you so long?" Say, "Oh, yeah, a German was sitting there smoking a cigarette, you know." That is that story. Well, anyhow, the Dutch government gave me 5. See, we called them by code bumblebees. And they gave me 5 bumblebees for recognition, you know.
And Mr. Smorenberg, the 5 bumblebees, the 5 represent the number of pilots that you rescued, is that right?
Please, I
The number, does that represent the number of pilots?
Huh?
Does that represent the number of pilots?
Yeah, the 5 pilots. Yeah. I personally picked out of the woods. Okay. See, our group got 9 of them, but all total, the Dutch resistance caught 127 of them. And all went to the city of Zuid-Limburg. And from Limburg, where the cement factory was, they bought it to the French. And it went all with coded messages, you know. So we never called it, say, there are 6 boxes, to give you an idea, there are 6 boxes of pears on your way. Please advise. Now, England know now that there were 6 boxcars with not pears, but peaches. It could be any kind of a fruit, you know. The first letter counted peaches, pears, whatever. So then we asked them, please advise. Then England contacted the French resistance in Lille, that is the northwest of France. And then England told us the next day, delivery confirmed. So we knew that the French knew that they were there to pick the pilots up.
Okay. Do you have any questions? Any questions? It doesn't look like anybody here has any questions, but we really appreciate you taking your time to be here today. And as soon as we have a quorum, I need one more body. We'll go ahead and see if we have enough votes to pass this measure to the Senate floor, and we thank you for your courage and your efforts and what wonderful stories you have to tell. Okay. So thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, Gus gave me a book describing some of the exploits and the things that they did, and I took it to a dear friend of mine, an ex-Marine from World War II, and gave him the book, and he said that he started talking about the experience of when we finally did the beachheads landings, our pilots were in the air, recognizing, as he did, the tremendous impact of the resistance fighters that were throughout Europe, and particularly mentioned the Dutch, and just really awesome, persistent fighters. On behalf of the...
I could show you something, and I could leave that with you.
You just have to take the spikes, and I told them you wouldn't use them if they didn't vote for it.
All right.
I think we have a quorum now, right. So we could probably move this bill. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Rule Resolution Number 1.
Madam
Chair. Senator Atkinson.
I would be honored to move SR1 before the Ducasse recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Resolution 1 to the Senate floor with a Ducasse recommendation. Is there any discussion of this motion? Is there any objection to the motion? It is so ordered, and Senator George, we would love for you to be the carrier.
I would love to do that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here today. Senator Metzger, come on up. We'll have a hearing on SJR 12.
Madam Co-Chair, SJR 12, upon approval by voters of the November 2004 general election, amends the Oregon Constitution to limit initiative petitions that amend the Constitution to the structure of government powers or election of government officials. It also authorizes the Secretary of State to determine whether initiative petitions meet this limitation.
Okay. Senator Metzger, before you get started, I want to make a couple announcements. For anybody in the audience, we are removing SJR 16, SJR 16 from the agenda. It will not be heard today. We'll be working to get that rescheduled. And we will do measure introductions and executive appointments when we're done with Senator Metzger's testimony. So please proceed, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and I bring before your consideration Senate Joint Resolution 12. Senate Joint Resolution 12 is identical, except for the year, to Senate Joint Resolution 21, which was passed by the Oregon Senate in 1999. In fact, every member of the body who was still here on this committee at that time voted affirmatively for the measure then, as it was carried by Senator Neil Bryan and myself in 1999. And as we have seen our initiative process create additional questions since then, I thought it would be valuable for this body to consider this piece of legislation again. Again, this passed the Senate and was at the Speaker's desk upon adjournment sine die in 1999. I believe you have passed out to you an amicus curiae by Dave Frohnmeyer relating to this issue. It's a fascinating brief, and I would suggest that you take the time to read it. It doesn't take long. Senator Bryant was very eloquent in talking about this. And Jim just says, I don't have it, right?
No, I'll get copies.
I'll see that. I'll Jim will see that you get copies of it.
I don't think they have copies at this time.
But Dean Frohnmeyer did on this issue after ballot measure 8 of the 1994 election. And, in fact, I noticed a couple of people in the audience here, Mr. Honeycutt, who had testified in favor of this as well before, because this issue really is has broad implications and broad-based support. Essentially, what it says is that, and the amicus makes it clear, that by Mr. Frohnmeyer, that in fact amendments to the Constitution through the initiative process really need to relate strictly to the organization and structure of government and limitation of government power, not private party power, private parties. In fact, the Lane County Court in hearing Measure 8 declared that Measure 8 was unconstitutional because it limited private parties. That went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, however, never ruled on that ruling because the issue of Measure 8 was declared moot on other grounds at that time before the Supreme Court, so it was never firmly litigated. But I'd like to just spend a couple of seconds talking about the summation of Senate Resolution 12 from Mr. Frohnmeyer's amicus. It says the issue is whether an initiative may properly amend the Oregon Constitution in order to place a law that is, in terms, directed against citizens beyond reach of legislative amendments or repeal. Do the words laws and amendments to the Constitution in Article 4, Section 1-2A allow initiating as amendments to the Constitution laws directly governing private conduct adopted without deliberation by elected, politically accountable lawmakers and beyond the ability of elected lawmakers to change? The answer is no. And the amicus goes on, and I won't go through that now because I know you have an agenda, but I think you'd like to find this very valuable to read this, that essentially these amendments are not proper. Why is this important? I think as you deal with different amendments to the Constitution is to look at why, you know, what is a Constitution? And amending the Constitution has become more popular to try and go beyond the reach of the legislature. The problem with that is that the constitutional amendments that are proper should, in fact, limit government. When you talk about tax issues and others that might come before the people as initiatives to the Constitution, those would be proper because you are limiting government power. But you shouldn't limit personal conduct. For example, according to the amicus and the Lane County Court on the Measure 8 case, if you were to have, hypothetically, an initiative to the Constitution, not a statutory, but an initiative to, amendment to the Constitution to, say, requiring farmers to fence their lands, that would be unconstitutional because of the fact, as Frohnmeyer argues, that you are limiting private conduct. If someone had taken, for example, the Measure 64 issue and said, we're going to make this an amendment to the Constitution so the legislature can't do this, the Frohnmeyer and Lindy in their amicus argue that would be improper amendment of the Constitution because you are limiting private conduct. Well, Legislative Council did a research at UFS of some other measures as to see how they would qualify under this amendment. Measure number 8, public employee contribution retirement, 1994 would fail that test because you would be limiting private conduct. Measure 39, prohibiting limitation on access to health care providers. You are trying to limit private conduct of private health care providers. It's not appropriate for the Constitution. Measure 41, expression of public employee earnings. And Measure 42, testing of public school students. Those would be proper as statutory changes to Oregon law, but not as amendments to the Constitution. I think, Madam Co-Chair, and I'll conclude with that, I would ask that you take a look at the amicus, and as you deal and wrestle with the issues of amendments through the initiative process, is to look at what the historical basis was when this was placed into effect in the early 1900s. And the amicus makes it clear that the initiatives to the amendments to the Constitution were to limit government, not to limit private conduct. And I think that's why you saw the vote so strong and so bipartisan in the Oregon Senate in 1999, because whether you represent labor or whether you represent farming and other groups, the biggest fear is that someone will put something in the Constitution out of our reach by limiting private conduct. It's unfortunate in many respects that the Oregon Supreme Court did not have a chance to issue a final ruling on Measure 8 based on the improper amendment of the Constitution because it was declared moot. But this body would have the opportunity once again to send to the voters of Oregon that amendments to the Constitution should limit government, should not limit private parties, and I would commend your consideration of that. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Metzger? Thank you. We will temporarily close the public hearing on SJR 12 and open a work session on measure introductions and bill requests. Mr. Stembridge, what do we have? Okay. Great.
Madam Co-Chair, co-chairs have approved two items for consideration, one for legislative drafting, one for introduction. First item is from the co-chairs for drafting modifications to the Oregon Health Plan. Second item is LC 3545, which you approved on Tuesday. This provides a different relating clause for a measure that Senator Shields has been working on relating to human services.
Senator Carno.
Madam Chair, I move we accept the measure drafting introduction requests for the Oregon Health Plan and LC 3545.
Senator Carno has moved that we approve the first request for drafting and regarding the Oregon Health Plan and the second request for an LC introduction, LC 3545. Is there any discussion about the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Next, we need to move to executive appointments. Mr. Stembridge, what do we have today in terms of executive appointments?
You have five executive appointments. We've determined that the appearances would be waived. I wanted to explain to the members the package of information you have on each. The first two sheets are generated by your staff. We have a cover sheet that describes the position, a little bit about the appointing authority, the qualifications for the positions, and also the duties that the position has. The second page ordinarily is going to be a list of the board members or commission members or whoever this appointment is joining. The remaining information that you have is information submitted from the governor's office on the appointees. Today you have four boards and commissions for the Oregon Board of Dentistry, Dr. Rodney Nichols, for the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, Dick Feeney, for State Parks and Recreation Commission, Nick Blosser, for the Oregon Racing Commission, Jeff Gilmore and Steve Walters.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clarno.
I would move we accept en bloc the executive appointments before us today.
Senator Clarno has moved that we accept en bloc the following appointments: Dr. Rodney Nichols to the Oregon Board of Dentistry, Dick Feeney to the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, Nick Blosser to State Parks and Recreation Commission, and two members to the Oregon Racing Commission, Steve Walters and Jeff Gilmore. Is there any discussion about these appointments? Is there any objection to these appointments? Senator Atkinson.
Gives me particular heartburn that we do not have Nick Blosser or Jeff Gilmore here to face the committee.
Well, I'm sure that they will hear of your sentiments through the discussion today, and I'm sure they will look forward to meeting with you and spending lots of time with you, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I do remember the first time Mr. Gilmore came before the Rules Committee. When was that, 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was one of the more eventful executive appointments that we had, and I was going to see if there was an encore performance.
Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I would remind the good senator that this is Mr. Gilmore we're talking about, and the less we see of him, the better.
thank you, Senator Corcoran. I would remind the members that any time you all wish to have appearances, you will be notified the Tuesday ahead of time about their appearances, and you can require that these members come before the committee. Thank you very much. And on that happy note, is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, it is so approved. Thank you. And next, I would open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 102. Mr. Stembridge, could you tell us what is happening?
Senate Bill 102 in its original form requires filing of not less than 10% of required signatures on a state initiative petition in order to obtain a ballot title. It declares an emergency taking effect upon passage. You have the dash three amendments, which we distributed last week. There is also in your packet an explanation from the Department of Justice on the dash three amendments. If anybody doesn't have the dash three amendments, I have additional copies of them. We put a few copies out on the table there, along with Mr. Schradl's explanation.
Thank you. It's my understanding that there are folks in the room who wish to testify who have not had an opportunity to testify. You want to raise your hand? You just want to come forward? There's no one. Okay.
Good. They know it's Thursday afternoon.
All right. Seeing as we are in work session, Senator Corcoran.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 102. I don't know if it's been amended.
Right. You need to move the amendment, Senator Corcoran.
Okay.
Dash three.
Well, I said the dash threes were moving. I do not have the amendments.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the dash three, adoption of the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 102.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. And could you tell us a little about the amendments in terms of the process and how we got here?
The dash three amendments actually incorporate the dash two amendments. After testimony during the public hearing, there was concern expressed about the process for developing a ballot measure summary that would be the basis for circulation for the first 10 to 15% of the signatures. So after discussion with several people in the Attorney General's office, it was decided to come up with the dash three amendments to eliminate the summary altogether and use the process that currently is in effect for gathering the first 25 signatures, which is to require that a copy of the measure itself be attached to the signature sheet for getting the first 10 to 15% of signatures. This gives the petitioner leeway to present the petition in a way that they see fit. As a former petitioner myself, I expect we would see from this titles that the petitioner comes up with as part of the measure. So given the concerns about the objectivity of the summary, I think this was a good compromise. The other purpose of the dash three amendments were to incorporate the existing requirements for constitutional procedural compliance into the due timeline. The intent was not to make substantive changes to the requirements and not to change the timelines under existing law, but to adapt them to the new procedure for getting the signatures.
Okay, thank you. Senator Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have asked, Senator Atkinson and I have asked an amendment to be drafted also in this bill. It is not here yet. The Legislative Council has not had a chance to finish it. But I guess I'd like to talk about that, and I think the process isn't how we get our ballot titles today is a problem, not how many signatures it takes to get there, which is what this bill deals with in the dash three amendments. So what Senator Atkinson and I have asked for and been notified that legislative council of what we, our original request down to legislative council might not work, so we have to modify a little bit, but was to, rather than the Department of Justice writing ballot titles, would be to have a legislative committee do that. Two members picked by the sponsor of the measure, two members picked by the Secretary of State, and the fifth member, and this is where we ran into some potential legal problems. We said the Supreme Court justice should pick the fifth member. Apparently, there is a problem with that because the Supreme Court may be ruling on this ballot measure at a later point in time. So, with that, we don't have a draft amendment yet. We don't have an amendment here. We're probably looking at another person to pick the fifth member, Secretary of State, or some other person. Or another option that was brought to my attention today by Senator Harper was a process that was worked on 2 years ago after that same bill had passed the House and came to the Senate. Is a process where the chief petitioner writes his or her own ballot measure, ballot title, and then a legal process, you know, to determine if that's a legal ballot measure, ballot title. So, with that being said, I'm going to oppose the motion to move the -3 amendments because I think there's a better way to do it. And to let you know, my own co-chairs, Senator Atkinson and I, if he in fact joins me in a no vote on the bill, we'll probably be issuing a minority report on the bill. So we have another option on the floor to actually fix the problem of how we get our ballot titles, not just change the process.
Thank you, Senator Breyer, for that heads up. I guess my question for you, my recollection is the last couple election cycles we've had, you know, 140, 150 ballot titles filed, and have you compared that to the measure summary process and sort of the hours that it would take for four legislative members to sit on each one of those 150 ballot title processes and the cost? Did you do any calculations?
Madam Chairman, it was brought to my attention today by the good Senator Harper, who is the Vice Chair of Ways and Means for the Senate, that the problem that he ran into in the 2001 session with a legislative committee's doing this is the cost. So that is why he presented to me this other alternative that gets the cost issue out of it, because this actually takes AGs off out of it too, unless there's a process that goes through the Supreme Court that and the Supreme Court says that the ballot title isn't accurate, then it would go back to the AG's office. So this process, in fact, and Senator Atkinson, I don't know if you've seen this yet, but we've been working on it in the last couple of days, frantically. But this actually would save money because the AG's office and the Secretary of State's office are both taken out of it. So anyway, we'll be probably seeing that on the floor.
So if I can follow up, the only challenge then under that process would be the ability of anybody who has standing to challenge it at the court level. Is that right?
Madam Chair, I'd have to go through this flow chart because I just received this myself after my discussions with Senator Harper. As I said, the amendments we asked for specifically out of legislators doing the ballot title writing. But because of cost and because of the Supreme Court not being able to appoint one member, we don't have that amendment in front of us at this point in time. So we will be looking at potentially something else on the floor. And I've got a flow chart here that Senator Harper gave me on how the system would work.
Right. Simple. Any other questions for Senator Beyer?
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Okay, I just had a question. Was it your intent, because you're really taking the whole ballot title process, not just, you know, the front end of it, but the whole process itself. Was it your intent to keep the 25 signature requirement before you initiate this legislative ballot title writing, or to require a higher level of signatures before that process is initiated?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, the amendment we sent to the Legislative Council request yesterday was to leave the 25 signature. Nothing else could change except for who writes the ballot title versus current law.
Is
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, it should be noted for the record that this is a friendly process and that the objection is friendly. And we realize that Senator Breyer and I both realize that we are outnumbered and that the procedure of going through the fix is a difficult one for both of us, both for Senate Bill 102 and another idea. This is something, though, that at least has been discussed since my time in the Rules Committee in 99 and in 01. And so it should be addressed, or it should be received as friendly, even though the process is a little sloppy and we haven't completely worked out all of the details. That is our intent to take, essentially, how can you effectively take the AG out of the process and still make it work, make it fair on both sides. Number two, an area that I raised when Senator Burdick was before us last time, the timeline. Again, I think the thing that is very interesting, especially if you look at Senator Burdick's ballot title, is Senator Burdick did it the right way. It was a grassroots campaign, and it was went out, you met all the hurdles, you met all the obstacles, and then you only had 85 days to get all those signatures. I still believe that is an inherent problem to the process. I think that drives pressure on the process that I don't like. And so part of one of the things, and I realize that I may be out on my own on this, but I don't like that timeline. I don't think it should be, as Senator Burdick said when I asked a question a couple weeks ago or last week, all these together. People are moving. It shouldn't be completely open. I think we're talking about a year and a half process. But I think these are all good things that go, all good ideas that go into the grist, and our objections should be recognized as friendly.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. I, of course, took it as a friendly objection. Senator Burdick.
Madam Chair, I take it as friendly as well, especially since Senator Atkinson left out the part where I said it was my deficiencies that got us into a situation where we only had 85 days. Thank you, Senator Atkinson.
So we look forward to further discussions about this issue on the Senate floor. Any other questions for Senator Burdick or Senator Beyer or Senator Atkinson? The motion. Senator Burdick's motion was to amend Senate Bill 102 with the -3 amendments. My understanding is there are two objections, Senator Beyer and Senator Atkinson. Is that correct? Okay. It is so approved. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 102 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 102 to the Senate floor with a due pass. Senate Bill 102 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendations. There are, my understanding, two objections, Senator Atkinson, Senator Beyer. With that, any other objections? Hearing none, the motion is approved. And Senator Burdick, we're going to let you carry that. And Senator Beyer and Senator Atkinson have given notice of minority report, and we look forward to having this discussion on the Senate floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for your information, it's my first time ever being on a minority report. So.
Also, Madam Chair.
If you need any technical advice, I'd be happy to.
Well, I might also point out, Madam Chair, that this, to my knowledge, this will be the first minority report from the Senate in this session, and I think it's very appropriate that kind of discussion will be held on the people's process, which is the initiative process. I think there's no, I think it's worthy of discussion, and I look forward to a good, robust discussion.
I think we should do it as a referral. Make yours a referral.
Not a bad idea.
All right.
It's
a referral.
So with that, we will open the public hearing on SJR 12. I believe it is the last bill before us today.
You're not going to move it, are you?
Would Kathy Eaton and Ken Tolinar come forward, please?
Mm-hmm. No.
No, they're kind of constituents. Yeah.
It's all winter.
Cappy, why don't you proceed since you're first on the list?
Thank you, Co-Chair Brown, Co-Chair Clarno, the other remaining member of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about SJR 12. I'm speaking as Cappy Eaton, the government chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We are in support of SJR 12. Most of you know that the League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization. We support and encourage citizen participation in government, and we attempt to educate voters with voter service activities and information. I would concur with some of the things that Senator Metzger also already has brought to your attention with regard to the need for constitutional amendments not to address extraneous material, extraneous people, extraneous interests such as the private interest group. However, we continue to look at the Constitution as the basic framework of Oregon government, and as such should not be subject to amendment for frivolous kinds of materials. We've been very concerned with the increase in the number of initiatives over the last two decades, particularly while we're a strong supporter of direct democracy. We also recognize that there's been an increasing number of initiatives over the last two decades, and that now a majority of those are constitutional amendments, and they have, when passed, added a tremendous amount of extraneous statutory material and detail into the Constitution. We feel that this is to the detriment of this basic framework of Oregon government. And so we feel that SJR 12, which would then limit such amendments to the structure and organization, election of officers, those kinds of issues that should be part of the Constitution, would be very appropriate. We're also very concerned about amendments to the Bill of Rights. There have been some. Fortunately, they have not either passed or were part of the court's removal of those issues. So we feel that SJR 12 would also address probably those threats to the Oregon Bill of Rights, because you would not be able to propose amendments in those areas. We believe that it's very appropriate for the Secretary of State to have the review process for these kinds of materials to determine whether there's the one subject and whether this does meet the criteria for just structure and organization of government. We feel that that review process is perfectly appropriate. We hope that you will, in your discussion, come to the conclusion that this really is an important measure for the voters of Oregon to decide once and for all that the Constitution is the basic framework of government and should not be subject to statutory detail and extraneous materials. Thank you.
Thank you. Ken Kolinar, welcome. It's good to see you today.
Thank you, Chair Brown, and members of the committee. I'm Ken Kolinar. I live in Eugene. I'm here only representing myself as an individual. Although I have had some dealings with the initiative process in recent years, I served as chair of the Eugene City Club's Committee on the Oregon Initiative Process, and in recent years I've been a member of the Oregon Initiative Committee, but I hasten to add that I'm not here representing either of those organizations, but simply myself. Very briefly, SJR 12 is consistent with a sort of a textbook principle that constitutions and city and county charters should be brief and general. They should establish, as Kathy says, the fundamental framework of government, but should not include administrative detail, and they should not leave the legislative body without flexibility it needs to deal with changing economic and social circumstances. Several of the recent constitutional amendments in Oregon have, at least in my opinion, appeared to violate this principle. And I've listed several in the second paragraph of my written testimony: lottery, the administrative detail that accompanied the Measure 5 and Measure 47, the inmate work requirements, the provision for sentencing, campaign finance reform was another one, I think, that included, was represented a violation of the principle of constitutions containing no statutory material, and home care services. Those are only amendments that actually were adopted by the people. If you counted the number of amendments proposed but not adopted, you have a large, much larger number than that. I might conclude by saying that several states have these kinds of subject matter restrictions. SAR 12 restricts initiated constitutional amendments to the basic structure of government and limitations on the power of the state, which I would assume includes civil rights. But restrictions of these types are not unheard of in other states that have the initiative process. Massachusetts, for example, includes bars constitutional initiatives that deal with freedom of speech, press, elections, right of assembly, just compensation, and so forth. Eight states prohibit initiated constitutional amendments that impose restrictions on taxes or make appropriations, and I've listed the names of those states in the text. Illinois is probably the most restrictive state in the country, since it allows only initiated constitutional amendments that deal with the structure and procedures of the legislative body. So in conclusion, I would just like to urge that the committee give its favorable consideration to SGR 12, and I believe it would be a great improvement in Oregon's initiative process.
Thank you. I have a question for either one of you. I taught a class last year at Portland State University, and in talking about the Constitution with my students, the best analogy I could come up with is the Constitution is the building structure, and the laws are the windows and the walls and everything that we put on the building. What do you think of that analogy? Pretty interesting, huh? Cappy's like, I don't know.
Well, part of the problem is that the statutes certainly provide what the Constitution lays as the groundwork, but you don't want all of the details of all of that into the Constitution. What you need is just the basic rule and then the legislation, which then would support that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the analogy, but it's kind of a new one on me. But the effort to restrict initiated constitutional amendments seems to me extremely sound. It leaves the legislature, SJR 12 would still leave the legislature with full scope of its existing powers to propose constitutional amendments, regardless of subject matter. But there's a great distinction between the initiative process and the legislative process. Initiative process involves kind of a private system of framing proposals, and those proposals submitted by some private group without major public input are then submitted to the people on a take it or leave it basis. Whereas in the legislature, as you well know better than I, you have public hearings, you have all sorts of opportunities to accommodate conflicting views and different interests in framing proposals for legislation and constitutional amendments. So they're two completely different processes, and I think that this fairly limited restriction that SJR 12 imposes is extremely reasonable.
Anybody else? Any questions? Senator Burton.
Yeah, thank you. I just really appreciate you coming, and I know that it's a quite a statement for a grassroots organization who has used the initiative process to come forward in support of this, and I really appreciate that. I also support it myself, and I think sometimes people think, well, petitioners think, well, if we don't put it in the Constitution, the legislature will go ahead and repeal it, and that just hasn't been the case. The legislators made a couple of attempts, but has failed badly. And if you look at some of the major initiatives that have passed, death with dignity, background checks at gun shows, minimum wage, even where attempts are made, they have not succeeded because the legislature is very keenly attuned to the will of the people. So I appreciate you coming to make these points, and also I appreciate your point about the deliberative process, because I know in my case where I did the background checks at gun shows was the initiative I did, and that sounds like a simple concept, but we went through hearings in both houses of this legislature, and that measure looked completely different than it would have if I had just sat down and written it without that kind of deliberation. And I think that's one of the reasons it's never even been challenged in court. Thank you.
Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jim, I know that we have some written testimony submitted by Common Cause.
Yes. Senator Brown, we wanted to make sure that Common Cause testimony, its written testimony, will get entered into the record. And then I did want to point out that the amicus brief that Senator Metzger was discussing, copies of that have been distributed to committee members and will also be made part of the committee record.
We will formally include the testimony of Common Cause on SJR 12 in the record, as well as the law review article written by Professor Lindy and Dean Frohnmeyer. Actually, it's President Frohnmeyer now. And those will be both entered in the record. Is there anybody here who wishes to testify on SJR 12 or any of the other members, any of the other proposals we have in front of us today? I am not seeing any volunteers, which means everyone in the audience knows that it's late Thursday afternoon. And with that, we will close, adjourn the committee, and thank all of you for being here today.